Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments, the long absence in episode 21 of the Vatican Centuries and bringing in the third Sunday in Advent on musical and reflective notes. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. I'd like to take you with me to Africa so I can introduce you to the Bishop of Umuahia in Nigeria, Lucius Iwajuri Ugoji, whom I recently met at the Synod for Africa, which took place in October here in the Vatican, an effort to discuss reconciliation, justice and peace across this vast continent. On this occasion, Bishop Ugoji was kind enough to share with me some thoughts regarding the impact of reckless exploitation of the environment on the part of multinational corporations. But I won't give too much away. Just listen to Bishop Ugoji.
Environmental degradation in Nigeria and elsewhere in Africa is something that is serious. Well, let's begin by saying that the environment that God created is a very beautiful one. And on account of human carelessness and recklessness, a lot is being degraded. In the northern part of the country, for instance, there is a lot of overgrazing. People cut wood for firewood, for charcoal. This has led to the expansion of the desert, the Sahara Desert. And it's expanding at a pace that is very threatening. So it's necessary that we call the attention of people to that.
You're talking about sub-Saharan Africa?
Yes. Then there is also the activities of multinationals, particularly in the Niger Delta area where they prospect oil. The Niger Delta area is where the wealth of the country is. But unfortunately, the environment is so degraded through oil spillage, so much so that those who were fishermen in the past can no longer undertake their occupation, as well as those who are farmers, because not only sea is polluted, but also land. So this has provoked many of the young people in the area to be militants. So we are encouraging multinationals that they rise up to their corporate social responsibility of helping to develop the area, building schools, hospitals, and the basic social infrastructure is needed in the area.
When you say we, you mean the church. How do you create this awareness?
The church has done quite a great deal. About 2 years ago, there was a seminar workshop on oil and gas. We invited all the stakeholders, both politicians, people from the oil sector, and so on. And at the end of the day, the church published a document on that, on oil and gas in Nigeria. I think it made some positive impact on some of the multinationals, but the degradation of the environment has continued.
It threatens the prospects of peace, or anyway heightens tensions and conflicts, no?
Yeah, it does, particularly in the Niger Delta area, where many young people now have taken to kidnapping for ransom. Initially, they were kidnapping people in order to draw attention to what is happening in the area. But midway, some elements of criminals crept into their ranks, and kidnapping now is spreading to different parts of the country, not only in the Niger area. So it is this degradation of the environment that has now sparked this off and is spreading, causing insecurity in different parts of the country.
Which is connected to multinationals exploiting, no?
Yes, it certainly is something that has triggered it off. So it's closely linked to it.
Did other people at the Synod speak about the environment? Do you feel that it was given enough attention?
Oh, very many interventions at the General Assembly revolved around the environment. And also in our small group discussion, a lot was also done about environment. And it's within that context that we also heard about how some multinationals go to Africa to buy up arable lands, and some cases wooded plains and valleys are destroyed because people cut these trees and transport them abroad. Especially the Chinese are doing that in many parts of Africa presently.
Are there so many Chinese?
In Nigeria, not as much as in other parts of Africa, but of course a good number are presently in Nigeria too.
What would you like to see happen in Nigeria in terms of greater awareness? Is there a network throughout Nigeria regarding this particular theme or not?
There are some NGOs that talk about the environment, and of course the church at the parish level, at the national level also. Sometime in the past, I think in the year 2000, we dedicated our cathedral. One of the major things we did was encouraging people to plant trees. If one cuts one tree, let him plant two. Africa is a continent that is blessed with many resources. And at the same time, whenever you are talking of development in the world, it appears to be at the bottom. Part of the problem is self-inflicted wounds on account of corrupt leadership. But other problems are from outside, namely the effects of colonialism and neo-colonialism, particularly in the area of international trade, the international debt burden, and of course the activities of multinationals. So these are some of the areas that have really impacted negatively on Africa.
And my thanks there go to the Bishop of Umuahia in Nigeria, Lucius Uwejuru Ugoji. And now our weekly rendezvous with an ambitious lady. She's Jill Bevilacqua, and I might say she thinks in centuries, at least Vatican centuries, having written and presented a 45-part series which takes us on a journey back in time to rediscover the lives and legends of the people and places that went into the making of the Vatican. Now, if you've been following this series produced by Sean Patrick Lovett, you'll know that in Chapter 20, by the title of Splendour and Decline, we heard about papal coronations in the Middle Ages, how Boniface VIII announced a jubilee year, and how St. Thomas Aquinas summarised Christian doctrine. Today, in episode 21, which Jill has called The Long Absence, we hear how the popes move to Avignon, how the Black Death rages in Rome, and on a more arty note, how Giotto decorates St. Peter's, and the poet Petrarch appeals to the Pope to return home.
Chapter 21, The Long Absence.
By the beginning of the 14th century, the medieval world was beginning to fall apart.
Gone was the certainty of its religious vision, with spiritual and political order founded on the dual authority of Pope and Emperor. With the gradual decadence of the feudal and hierarchical institutions, a new sense of nationalism was emerging.
It was a period of sharp contrasts. In Europe, there was great social stress. Italy was torn by political turmoil.
England and France, constantly fighting, now became involved in the Hundred Years' War. And from Eastern Asia came disease, the Black Death, sweeping across the continent, and in a space of 20 years reducing its total population by a third. It claimed over 60 million victims.
For the Church, too, it was a troubled time. There was a diminishing of authority due to the transfer of the papal court to Avignon. This period of exile, which lasted nearly 70 years, was known as the Babylonian captivity, recalling the imprisonment of the Israelites in Babylon.
But it was an epoch which saw a great flowering of mystics and contemplatives. Catherine of Siena, Julian of Norwich, John of Raisbrook, and Richard Roll. The Italian sculptor Pisano was working in bronze and marble. Froissart was writing his chronicles of Western Europe, Boccaccio his Decameron, while on the capital, the poet and scholar Petrarch was crowned with laurel.
Although the official seat of papal government had always been Rome,
Since 1100, the popes had only actually resided in the city for 82 years, but they'd never lived outside Italy.
Now, in 1308, the newly elected French pope, Clement V, announced officially that the papal curia was to remove to Avignon in the south of France. Six more French popes followed, but the papal court remained captive, for the French kings wished to keep the popes under their influence, and many of the French cardinals disliked living in Italy. Then Benedict XII, 1334 to 1342, began the building of the great papal palace in Avignon. It seemed that the popes were lost to Rome.
Conditions in the Eternal City were desperate. There was no effective government, and the people, with no law to protect them, defended themselves as best they could. Delinquency was rampant and human life held lightly. Money was stolen, cattle abducted, houses burnt down, women raped, convents raided. Every morning, corpses were swept from the streets and thrown into the Tiber with the refuse.
The buildings, too, were in a sorry state. Many of the churches and papal palaces were in various stages of decay, damaged by fire, old age, weather, and the repeated sackings and pilferings of stonework, statuary, and tiles. The Milvian Bridge had been razed to the ground by the Orsini family, who owned the only other bridge near Castel Sant'Angelo. The belfry of St. Peter's had been destroyed by lightning. And on May 6, 1308, the Church of St. John Lateran caught fire and was seriously damaged. Columns, monuments, and the roof were devastated. It seemed like a divine punishment for the abandonment of the city by its bishop.
The people were desolate. They walked the streets in procession, dolefully chanting psalms, until they reached the smoking basilica. Then they set to work clearing the debris. Offerings poured in for the reconstruction, and Clement V ordered that it be undertaken immediately. But in 1360, fire broke out again, and this time Giotto's fresco of the Jubilee of 1300 was almost totally destroyed.
The pilgrims who came to Rome for the Jubilee of 1350 saw a very different picture from their predecessors. To the absence of the Pope was added the ruinous aspect of the city, which only a year or so before had been shaken by earthquake. On that occasion, the Church of the Twelve Apostles crumbled to dust, St. Paul's was badly damaged, and the façade of the Lateran Basilica collapsed.
Although there are no written records of the Black Death in Rome, an eloquent memorial still exists in the marble staircase leading up to the Church of Arcelli on the Capitoline Hill. In that church was an image of the Virgin, to which the Romans attributed the ending of the epidemic, and in 1348 they built the staircase as a thank offering.
Probably the last artistic work of any importance to be done in old St. Peter's was that performed by Giotto at the turn of the century. He was commissioned by the Pope to depict five scenes from the life of Christ for the high altar.
The Pope rewarded him with 600 gold ducats and was so pleased with his style that he ordered the artist to decorate the interior with scenes from the Old and New Testaments. Much of Giotto's work was lost when the old basilica was demolished, but some pieces were saved and transferred to the new building.
The best-known piece of work, which can still be seen today, is the Navicella mosaic, representing the bark of St. Peter's tossed on the waves. The work was said to have cost over 2,000 florins.
If we look up above the central portal of St. Peter's before entering the church, we can still see the relic of the Navicella, scarcely distinguishable among the shadows. One can pick out Christ walking on the waters, and below him, almost invisible, the donor, Cardinal Stefaneschi, nephew of Boniface VIII, who gave the mosaic to old St. Peter's in 1298.
Legend has it that Giotto was discovered at the age of 10 by the painter Cimabue, making drawings of his father's sheep on stones. Cimabue took him to Florence to teach him art, and Giotto was soon drawing so accurately from life that he made a definite break with the crude Byzantine style. The technique of life drawing had been neglected for some 200 years. Now Giotto restored it, and by representing nature closely and using a greater lightness of colouring than his master, he brought the art of painting to life.
There's a story that when Giotto was still a young man in Cimabue's workshop, he painted a fly on one of the master's figures. It was so lifelike that when Cimabue returned, he tried several times to brush it off with his hand till he realised his mistake.
Giotto began by working on mosaic and ended in architecture. But his most important work was as a muralist, and his frescoes in the Avena Chapel in Padua are considered the greatest of his surviving works, while the best known are probably the Assisi frescoes, still admired by thousands of pilgrims each year. In 1334, Giotto was made chief architect of Florence Cathedral, and the Campanile, known as Giotto's Tower, was his masterpiece of design.
Time passed, and gradually the papacy regained control in Italy, so that the popes were able to consider returning to Rome.
In 1362, a Benedictine was elected, who took the name of Urban V. The poet Petrarch saw in this choice of name a whole program, for the name Urban was taken from Urbe, or city. The new pope also had been apostolic delegate in Naples and knew the country.
Petrarch decided to appeal to the new pontiff to bring the papal court back to Rome.
In the absence of the legitimate husband, there is no more peace. Wars follow ceaselessly on each other. The houses totter. The temples and walls are crumbling. Civil life no longer flourishes behind the protective shield of the law. How then can the Pope have the courage to fall asleep beneath the gilded ceilings of the Palace of Avignon? And how can the cardinals seat themselves calmly on gold and ivory stools when the Lateran, mother of all the churches, is roofless, open to the fury of wind and rain? When the holy houses of Peter and Paul are on the verge of collapse? When what was once the dwelling of the apostles is nothing but an amorphous mass of stones which would touch even the hardest heart? A city in ruins, but nevertheless, a sacred city.
And heartfelt thanks there go to Jill Bevilacqua for yet another episode of the Vatican Centuries in this series produced by Sean Patrick Lovett, whom we thank as well. Be sure to tune in at the same time next week for episode 22, when we'll already have reached the 14th century and two women pressure Pope Gregory XII to return home and set up papal residence in the Vatican. Moving on in the broadcast, it's time now to respect the liturgical calendar on a musical note. That's with Monsignor Philip Whitmore.
For a young child, the days leading up to Christmas are full of excitement. I can remember how I used to count the days, opening a new door on my Advent calendar for each day of December as the 25th came closer and closer. When it gets to 8 days before Christmas, the church begins a kind of countdown. The readings at Mass tell us the story day by day leading up to the birth of Jesus in Bethlehem. And every day from the 17th of December right through to the 23rd, there's a beautiful plain chant antiphon to sing each day at Vespers. All seven of them contain an urgent plea. Veni, come Lord, come. Veni, each of these antiphons begins by addressing our Lord with a title taken from the Old Testament. O Adonai, O Key of David, O Emmanuel. That's why they're called the O antiphons. The first in the series is called O Sapientia, O Wisdom, You come forth from the mouth of the Most High. You fill the universe and hold all things together in a strong yet gentle manner. O come to teach us the way of truth. These seven antiphons are full of wonderful images expressing the hope of God's people waiting for the birth of the Saviour. O Radix Jesse, O Root of Jesse, kings fall silent before you, whom the peoples acclaim. O come to deliver us. That's the antiphon for the 19th of December. And you'll notice it uses the same music as the one we had before. In fact, all the O antiphons have the same music, slightly adjusted to match the words each time. I expect you can all think of examples where the same hymn tune can be used with different sets of words. But I was fascinated to find examples of the same thing happening in plain song. All the O antiphons use the same music. And so too does a completely different antiphon, O Doctor Optime, sung at Vespers on the feast of a Doctor of the Church. Those monks who put the chant books together knew how to make the most of a good tune. But jumping ahead a few centuries, some Victorian hymn writers decided they wanted to make the most of the wonderful texts of the O antiphons. The well-known Advent hymn we heard at the start of the programme is a kind of collage of all the Old Testament images used in the O antiphons. The tune is an old French processional chant. The words express our fervent Advent hope. O come, thou key of David, O come, thou dayspring, come and cheer our spirits by thine advent here. The refrain expresses the joy that comes bursting out of us as we await the coming of the Lord.
And warm thanks there to Monsignor Philip Whitmore, a music historian who's currently working as an official at the Vatican's Secretariat of State. Finally, as we know, Advent is a time of hope. As well-known author Jesuit Father Gerald O. Collins points out in this reflection, in which he connects Advent to Pope Benedict XVI's November 2007 encyclical on hope, Spe Salvi. Let's listen.
Advent is a time when we think about God, about the God who's coming to us. And I think a lot about that lovely phrase that recurs in the book of Revelation, God is the God who is, who was, and who is to come. The author of that wonderful last book of the Bible doesn't say the God who is, who was, and who will be. No, the God who is, who was, and who is to come. And that puts a stress on the future, the futurity of God. God is the God who's coming to us. In his encyclical, Saved by Hope, the Holy Father has some lovely reflections about the God who is to come in judgment. And judgment is not a terrifying thing, but it's a thing we can welcome and look forward to. We look forward to the birth of Jesus liturgically, but we also look forward to the Last Judgment. And God is going to see that justice is done. The world is full of so much injustice and suffering, and yet are we going to forget all that? But no, God is not going to forget all that. God is going to really see that, not in a vindictive way, that justice is done, that the victims have the last word, not the perpetrators of outrages. And I found it marvellous in that section of his encyclical that the Holy Father drew on two great Jewish scholars from Frankfurt, Theodor Adorno and Max Horkheimer, who really didn't come to Christian faith, but they asked the right question. Are the perpetrators going to triumph over the victims? And they said that cannot be. They asked the question, in Jesus we have the answer, that the justice is going to be vindicated and Last Judgment is something to look forward to with great joy and hope. And I was so pleased to see the Holy Father in his encyclical bringing out that theme about the Last Judgment. So often we can think of the Last Judgment as something terrifying, you know, will I go to heaven or hell? No, but he thinks of it as a time when justice will be done and will be seen to be done for everybody. I think Advent also is a time of thinking about justice, but also making a leap of faith like the Blessed Virgin Mary. She couldn't rehearse, practice that scene when Gabriel came to her. There was the question out of the blue, and thank God she answered right. She never practiced that, but she really came through with colours flying. Well, we don't always do that, but let's try to do it. Let's try to imitate her and come through saying yes to God in faith and in hope. I think Advent is a time of welcoming. The Holy Father's produced the encyclical on the 30th of November, and on the 14th of December, the Congregation for the Doctrine of Faith works for him. They're going to produce a document on evangelization. And that's a lovely document for Advent too, because they say we have such good news and we should share it with everybody, that Jesus is sheer good news and we shouldn't keep him to ourselves, but let others know about it through our example, but also through our words. We focus on Christ this Advent by thinking of his amazing humility, a baby in Mary's arms, a baby that cried out for food. I mean, think about the Son of God who came to go through the whole messy thing that we've been through.
Thanks there to well-known author, Jesuit Father Gerald O'Collins, for sharing with us this reflection. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. Thanks for listening. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Bye for now.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.